Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It's Friday, and that means Free for All Friday is back. My most sincere apologies for the previous Friday that we did not have an episode. That was our Founders Weekend here at Catholic Answers. We're spending time with supporters, longtime supporters of the apostolate here in San Diego. And so the whole weekend just got blacked out. Radio station was closed. Had a lot going on. It was great, but I did still feel a little bit of regret that I didn't get you an episode. And then I started to worry. Well, if I don't get an episode up on Friday, what if people lose faith in the podcast? And then what if they decide they'll never listen again? And then what if no one ever reads any of my books, listens to my podcast? No one ever thinks I'm a good apologist anymore. Then Catholic Answers lets me go. And then we can't pay our mortgage. And then we're homeless. And what have I done? You might say, wow, that's a bit of a stretch, Trent. That's kind of illogical, irrational, kind of worrying. Well, if you have a penchant for worrying, if worry is something that gets to you, I think you'll enjoy today's episode. I want to talk about worrying and how to overcome that. But before I do, of course, to help stave off my worries that my family be homeless and can't care for them, just kidding, I don't actually worry about that. But I do want to make sure the podcast keeps going well and can reach lots more people. I worry about people who need to hear the Word of God, need the gospel in their lives, and for some reason or another, they don't hear that. So I want to keep expanding that as much as I can, and your generous support of the Council of Trent podcast makes that possible, especially for those of you who are premium subscribers who make a monthly donation at trenthornpodcast.com for as low as $5 a month. You get access to bonus content, $10, you get a nifty t-shirt, and other reward tiers along the way. Please check that out at trenthornpodcast.com. You won't regret it. Now, onto the subject of worrying. A few weeks ago, my wife and I decided to take the kids up to Disneyland. Actually, I had a day off, and I decided just to buy some annual passes because we live here, and I got the cheapest ones, actually. They're the ones for Southern California residents that basically everything is blacked out except for the middle of the week, and you can't go in summer. But that works for us, actually, because a lot of times I travel. I mean, I travel two or three times a month. Usually when I go and I do speaking events, I'm usually away over a weekend, so I can just take a Tuesday or a Wednesday off when nobody's there and drive the kids up. But before we went, I saw that the day I wanted to go that it might be raining, and I just started freaking out with my wife. I was thinking, oh, you know, what if it rains too hard and the kids are miserable and we're tired and we're cold and wet and the kids are crying all the time and you know, we're having just really awful time and we just waste a bunch of money going to the drive up there. And she said, why are you worrying about that so much? So I don't know. I've always been a worrier. I hate it. I don't want to be this kind of person. And maybe you're that kind of person. So on the way up, my wife had been listening to an audiobook that I now just got here as a paperback I'm holding in my hands. A book I highly recommend to you if you or someone you know or love has a concern about worry. It's called The Worry Cure, 7 Steps to Stop Worry from Stopping You by Robert L. Leahy. And so book was written several years ago. Leahy actually just came out with a new book called The Jealousy Cure, I think just last year, actually. But I like the book because it's a form of cognitive therapy that basically the principle of cognitive therapy is that if you can change your distorted thinking about the world, you are going to be a happier and healthier person. And this really lies in with our faith, because a lot of people think, well, if you just have faith, you won't worry. And there's a bit more to it than that. But this was something even Jesus had to address. You remember in the Gospels when Jesus said, how can worrying add a single moment? I think he actually, in Greek, he said a single cubit to your lifespan. Jesus said, how can worrying add a single moment to your lifespan? That we can get lost in worry and upset, wondering about what is going to happen, regretting what did happen that didn't go our way. But I think a lot of times, though, most of our worries tend to be forward thinking. Sometimes it's past thinking. We worry about what happened in the past and wish that we could change things. A lot of times, though, and for me, worry tends to be really a forward thinking problem. You fear some kind of obstacle, some kind of danger, some kind of threat looming over the horizon, and you don't have certainty, and you wish you had certainty in life. And you're scared about what might happen if this bad thing were to strike your life. And so you take different steps to try to deal with worry or to deal with those threats. For me, to let you into my life a little bit, the things that I worry about, the things I worry about the most are the things that are within my control and what I could have done something about. And I feel a deep sense of regret or guilt if I did not act in a certain way to prevent those bad things from happening. So, you know, you have some people who are hypochondriacs. They think that they're always sick, or they're worried about getting sick. So you have some people, you know, they think that any little cough or lump or rash means they have cancer. And then they go on WebMD, you know, they look up lump under skin, what symptoms? And then WebMD says, well, it could be this, it could be that, or it could be cancer. It seems like any symptom you look up on WebMD, it always, I think like contractually it has to say, it could be this or that, or it could be cancer. And then if you're worried about cancer, you see cancer under there. But for me, like diseases afflicting myself, my family, it's not something I've ever really worried too much about because there's nothing I can really do. And that's just me. Now, other people, they're concerned about that. And the book deals with how you can confront worries that you really have no control over. For me, I worry about something bad happening if I know there is something I could have done differently, even if it's a ridiculous, outlandish set of steps I could have taken, that if I could have done something differently, then I think to myself, well, then it's my fault. And for me, the reason that I do that is because I have a very internal locus of control. I might have mentioned this in a previous podcast, but if not, it might be good to share with you all listening. And you could ask yourself, which one do I fall into? Because most people fall into one of these two categories when it comes to answering the question, who is in control of my life? And there's really two big camps people fall into. First, there's external locus of control. So people who have an external locus of control think most of the big things, the things that are important in their life, the things that matter, are really not controlled by them. They're controlled by other people. It's out of their hands. So when something bad happens, they're the kind of people, you know, who are quick to blame everybody else. You know, it's my parents' fault for raising me this way. It was the judge's fault in this case. You know, he was mean. He was unfair to me. That police officer was out to get me. This person was out to get me. I got a bad report at work because my supervisor's unfair and he's jealous of me. And, you know, so you when bad or any other kind of bad thing that happens, it's always somebody else's fault. That you feel if you have an external locus of control, that where you go in life is where the wind kind of takes you. And when good things happen, it's because other people helped you. And when bad things happen, it's because other people hurt you. And so it's really up to a lot of things beyond your control. And so that can free you up inside, not having to worry as much about what you do. But it can also generate feelings of helplessness. So like, well, I can't really do anything on my own. So that's the external locus of control. Me, I have always been really an internal locus of control kind of person. So people with an internal locus of control think that when something good or bad happens in their life, usually it's because of something that they did. And it's, in my case, especially if something bad happens, my wife will say this. She'll say, Trent, it's so naggable when you do this. That if something bad happens, I blame myself, even if it's not directly my fault, as if I should have been the one to think ahead and realized that the stroller wasn't in the back of the car when we, you know, when we went to the zoo and now we got to lug, you know, our toddler around who now, it was fine when they're like a newborn and they weigh nothing. But then when your toddler reaches the sack of potatoes stage and you got to lug them around everywhere, you start to feel it. As to say, well, I should have double checked and I should have done this. I should have done that. It was on me and I blew it or I failed. And you get this deep sense of mourning and regret that if something bad happens, it's because of you. Now, there's pluses to being someone who has an internal locus of control. These kinds of people tend to be very self-motivated. They're self-starters. They tend to be very ambitious in life, accomplish projects they set their minds out to. Maybe they write, I don't know, 7 books. You know, they say, well, I want to go and I want to get this done. My wife and I, it's so funny, we'll joke about these things. You know, she's got more of a sanguine personality. She'll say, oh, it would be really great if we ever went to this place on vacation. Then like a half hour later, we're at home together. And I say, I'm looking up stuff on Expedia. What do you think about this for an airline ticket price? I think we can get a good deal on that. And I start putting everything together. She says, Trent, I was just talking about that. Now you're planning and making everything happen. So the life of, and we'll talk about temperaments, I think, on a future Free for All Friday, the life of the sanguines versus the melancholics on the other temperaments. We'll talk about that another time. But having an internal locus of control also has its downsides, of course, as I've mentioned, that you feel it's all on you. And especially as a person of faith, that's not a great thing because you have to always remember God is in the ultimate control of our lives. I don't know who said it. It's probably a common phrase. But if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans. that I have planned so many things out of my life, and God just took a sharp left-hand turn and said, no, I want you to do this instead. And so we have to be flexible and willing to let God lead us in our lives where he wants us to go. But what do we do when we've got that worry and that anxiety? We're not sure we want God to pull the steering wheel into that direction. What do we do to counteract worry? What I want to share with you is some things in this podcast. I'm not going to summarize the whole book. The book is great. I definitely recommend you picking it up. The Worry Cure by Robert Leahy. But I just want to share with you things that don't work, things that haven't worked, including for myself, when it comes to trying to counteract worry. And then ways that do work, cognitive therapy, just little ways you can change your thinking to help worry, turn worry into something productive. That if we think there's nothing wrong with being prepared, there's nothing wrong with surveying consequences and choosing a decision that has the least negative consequences. There's nothing wrong with those behaviors. Worrying is a problem when there's a debilitating fear about the future or a concern about a loss of certainty that prevents us from being happy or from living our lives the way we would like to live them. All right, so what doesn't work when we're stuck with worries? Or I was talking to a woman who helps children, actually, with cognitive therapy to help children overcome anxiety. And when she talks to them, she says to them, what is the worry monster up to today? So maybe the worry monster is getting inside your head. How can we beat the worry monster? So what are ways we try to fight the worry monster and it doesn't work? Here's number one. We try to seek reassurance. You know, we worry about something and we say to our friends, to our spouses, to our classmates, our coworkers, do you think this is going to go okay? Do you think I look okay? I think that project went pretty well. Do you think that they probably were okay with that? What do you agree with me, right? You think it's okay, or this is nothing to worry about, right? You think so. And we seek reassurance, but the problem here is we're still really attached to our worries. So what happens is if that people try to disagree with us and try to dissuade us of our worries, we don't listen to them. We don't believe it. We start thinking in our head, even if a spouse says, oh, you have nothing to worry about. Well, they're my spouse. They're supposed to say something to make me feel better. They're not objective. Or they're my friend. They're just trying to help. But this person just wants to be nice, but they don't understand the situation like I do. So what they said doesn't help. Unless the person says something that feeds into our worry, then for some reason we go ahead and listen to them. And I do this all the time as a public speaker, as a writer, that my work, when it goes out in the public square, if you want to be an apologist, you want to be an evangelist, someone who publicly has a large platform to defend our Catholic faith, you need to have a thick skin. But this still gets to me that I will look at reviews for my books or look at feedback from a talk. Sometimes at talks, there are feedback cards to see how you did. And I could see 99 cards that say, you know, 3 out of 5 stars or higher, 4 out of 5 stars or higher. It's great, loved it. And I'll read, you know, 99 of those. But the only one I will remember is the one that gave me 1 star and said, this is a horrible presentation. And that's the one that will stick with you, the one negative. And it doesn't matter. There could be 99,000 positive reviews. But for some reason, you just discount them. So seeking reassurance against our worries isn't helpful because we just end up discounting that reassurance. Number two, thought stopping. So we think that, you know, we're worried. And I have a worried thought, I'm worrying and I'm obsessing about this, just stop it. I'm just going to stop it, stop thinking about it. Or we'll have friends, they'll tell us, hey, just stop thinking about that. Just don't think about that, man. And we'll say to ourselves, I'm not going to think about that. Well, does that work? All right, let's try an experiment. Don't think about pink elephants. Whatever you do, I'm going to count to three. Do not think of a large, funny, animated pink elephant. 1, 2, 3. You're thinking about a pink elephant, aren't you? I know it's in there. There's at least a faded image of a pink elephant in your mind. Studies have actually shown that when people are told to not think about something, they are more likely to think about it. That actually has been concluded in psychology studies, that when you're told not to think about something or obsess over something, you still think about it. So thought stopping doesn't work. Trying to just banish thoughts from our mind, it doesn't work. They're still there. We have to do something productive with them, even if they are worrying thoughts. Number three. Collecting information. This one is bad for me. Oh, gosh, I do that. Sometimes I worry about something. So me being, you know, a researcher, a writer, someone who enjoys learning about new things, I feel, well, if I just knew enough about this situation, I wouldn't worry about it anymore. So I go out and collect information. So maybe you're worried about getting a certain disease. So you go and you read up on this disease everywhere you can, or you're worried about something bad happening to your house, you know, some maintenance issues. So you go and you read up on that. But the problem is you cannot become an expert overnight. So when you go and you read up on this thing, you usually practice confirmation bias. It's a psychological tendency we all have. It's a bias in our thinking, a distorted kind of thinking, where we go, and if we're already committed to an idea, we will absorb data or facts that confirm what we already believe, and we will conveniently ignore, refute, or overlook facts that disconfirm that. So if we think we have cancer, we will remember every single journal article we've ever read that says our symptoms are cancerous and overlook the other data that says, well, usually though, it refers to this or to that, refers to this or that. The same things when it comes to disasters. You know, and on this show, I'm actually not that worried about disasters. This is one area of my life, because like if my plane crashes, once again, internal, external locus of control, there's really nothing I can do to keep myself from, if I were to die in a plane crash. I used to sit in the very back of the plane, because there's a slight, like 5 or 10% chance of surviving a plane crash. You have like a 10% better chance of surviving a plane crash if you're sitting in the back of a plane versus the front of a plane, because planes don't back into mountains, is what I've read on one website. So I used to, when I was booking my flights or when I would be on Southwest, I'd be first in the plane and I'd go and sit in the very back of the plane. And then I got sick of it because I realized, wait a minute, this isn't rational. The cost-benefit trade-off, there's too much of a trade-off here because, yeah, I'm reducing my chance of dying in a plane crash, which is, statistically speaking, when I really look at the statistics, is extremely rare. It is very rare. If I had to bet money, if I tried to win money on a bet when it comes to dying in a plane crash, I would laugh because those odds would be so astronomically against me. Where so the trade-off is, yeah, I'm 5% safer in something that's probably never going to happen, and yet now I got to smell the bathroom at the back of the plane and it takes me an extra 15 minutes to get off the plane. No, thank you. It's too much of a trade-off. So, and so there with, you know, with disasters, you might think you go collect information on dying in a plane crash and you only remember these horrible disasters, these emotional images, these recent things. You might remember if you're anxious about a certain kind of bad thing that's happened in the news, you'll think it's more prevalent than it really is because you've seen it in the news over and over again. You might think, oh no, I'm worried about my kids being shot at school, at a school shooting, and it's getting worse and worse and worse. And yet, if you look at the FBI crime statistics, you'll see that violent crime is at an all-time low since the early 1990s. We're actually at a very low point for violent crime in the United States. But if you don't look at the right data, if you go looking for information in all the wrong places, you're going to have a skewed look, and it's going to further distort your thinking about the issue. So collecting information is usually not good because it feeds your worry. It doesn't disquiet it. Here's the next one. Number four, you avoid discomfort. So sometimes when you worry, you think, well, I'm just not going to become uncomfortable. I worry about my finances. I'm really worried that I'm not going to be able to pay the bills. So what am I going to do? I'm just never going to open my bank account. I'm not going to look at it. If I don't know what is in my bank account, I can't be worried about it. Well, the problem is that works for a few hours, a few days, until you get an email saying that your bank account has been overdrawn. And now the problem is you've made the problem worse. So now you're basically, the problem is going to come back later and you'll have to pay interest on it. By ignoring the problem, whatever you're worrying about, it gets worse and worse and worse. So when it does pop up, if you avoid discomfort, you get more of a problem, and you've already conditioned yourself to think, I can't handle being uncomfortable. Because the only way we can fight our worries, the only way we can live a worry-free life, is to get used to being uncomfortable. If we can't handle discomfort, we can't handle worry. Because at the very least, we will always have discomfort or uncomfortable thoughts, or we'll have to do things to overcome our worry that are uncomfortable. But if we train ourselves to think that we can't do something uncomfortable, then we generate helplessness. So one thing Leahy recommends is to write down a journal, and journaling is actually something, another solution we'll come back to later, saying, remember times when you had to do something uncomfortable. What did it feel like before? What did it feel like afterwards? What was the benefit to your life when you did that uncomfortable thing? To remember, you and I do uncomfortable things all the time. We experience discomfort all the time in order to achieve a greater good in our lives. So we hold our urge to go to the bathroom when we're on the plane until it touches down or until we're able to. We experience discomfort. That way we don't, you know, we don't soil ourselves and have an even worse time. We are used to lots of different things in life, doing things that are uncomfortable to secure something that's a better good for us. And we can do it. If we can do it in these settings, if we can be uncomfortable at least at some point in life, we can be uncomfortable in many, many other points. It's like a muscle. We can just flex it and make it grow and work it over and over and over again. And the more we get used to being uncomfortable, ironically, the more comfortable we are in those particular settings. Let me go through a few others before I talk about the better ways to overcome worry. Let's see. Number five, you overprepare. I do this. Okay, well, I'll have a backup plan. I'll have another backup plan for this. I'll have a backup plan for that. If that is your only solution to worry is to have backup plans and to prepare, the problem is you could prepare ad infinitum. I mean, you know, I did the shows about what to do in disasters. The problem is there could be another disaster. There, you know, your supplies could be stolen. You could think of anything you have to prepare you for a problem in life, another problem threatening that solution, and you have an infinite chain. And so you're never prepared enough. Something else that I've done is you check the locks, you check the oven, you get obsessive compulsive, you check things over and over and over again. It's like drinking salt water. Checking once might make you feel better, but then, you know, it just makes you thirstier and thirstier. You have to check over and over and over again. Finally, I'll do two other things. Similar to avoiding discomfort, you numb yourself with food, alcohol, or drugs. If I'm worried about something, well, I'm going to take myself out of it. I'm going to avoid discomfort by numbing myself with food, alcohol, or some kind of medication or drugs. Now, that's not saying that it's wrong to use antidepressant or anti-anxiety medication. That is something that restores a balance if there is a chemical balance in your brain to use medication. What I'm talking about is using recreational drugs or even any other kind of drug like caffeine, using these things to numb you. You're not dealing with the imbalance that you might have a chemical imbalance in your brain. What you're dealing with is just trying to numb your body so you don't think about the problem. And then just like avoiding discomfort, the problem comes back worse in the future. You also ruminate. You know, we think, I should have done this, I should have done that. What about this and what about that? Or how did this go over? So instead of thinking about a productive solution, like, well, here's this problem, what are some steps to overcome this problem? We just think about the problem, its effects, and what we could have done differently in the past. And so we ruminate, like a cow that just chews the same thing over and over and over again, but you're not digesting, you're not getting anything done. And the last one, you refuse to accept that you have crazy thoughts, that we don't just say to ourselves, you know, that's just a crazy thought. Sometimes I just get a crazy thought and I think of a danger that is completely outlandish and that's probably not going to happen. But for some reason it sticks with me. And part of this comes from our evolutionary history, that I think worry is a holdover from our ancestors who survived in a very, very harsh environment. So think about Stone Age man, Fred Flintstone, not with the talking dinosaurs, but our ancestors, the ones who survived carried their genes on with us, passed those tendencies along. If a trait helped them to survive, we probably inherited it. And so worry helped some of them survive, worry and concern, because for them in a very harsh environment, it is better to worry about a danger and things turn out fine than to fail to worry and get eaten by a saber-toothed tiger. So for our ancestors, when there was a danger lurking around every bush, worry was helpful. What also was helpful for our ancestors was eating as much fat and salt as they could find, because those were in scarce supply. So when they got to an animal, the taste for, oh, I got to get the fat right off this animal and the salt and the really good tasting stuff because it's high in calories and will keep me alive, that worked for our ancestors who didn't have refrigerators and drive-thrus. But the problem is we live in the modern world now, where it's really not that dangerous, at least here in the United States and in modern Western worlds. Even in undeveloped countries, it's still far safer than in the Stone Age. And so these Stone Age tendencies we have, whether it's to eat salty, fatty foods or to worry, might have helped our ancestors survive. They're killing us. They're giving us heart disease. They're giving us high blood pressure. We can't let them control our lives. So let's talk about what does work then. So I talked about one thing that doesn't work, refusing to accept you just have crazy thoughts that just pop in your mind. Well, one thing that works is putting space between you and your thoughts. So instead of saying to yourself, I'm really depressed right now, you can say, I'm having depressed thoughts, or I'm having a thought about being depressed. And that little way of putting space allows you to take a step back and see, is this a rational thought or an irrational thought? I am totally overwhelmed with stress about what's happening at work. I am having a feeling of stress about work. Is this something I should be feeling? I am having a thought about being afraid about this. I am having a worry about this. What should I do with that? It's a very subtle thing, but notice it's not thought stopping. Thought stopping doesn't work because the thought stays there, but it gives you a gap to step back and say, okay, I'm having this thought. What am I going to do with this? And it gives you a little breathing room so that the anxiety of worry doesn't come over you. Number two, what would you tell someone who is in the exact same position as you? That if you saw someone, especially your child or a loved one, experiencing this worry and being debilitated by it, what would you say to them if you were in the outside? You're not afraid this is going to happen to you. You can picture them having the same worry. What would you say to them? And that could be helpful that when you look at it from a different perspective, you can say, well, I would tell them, honestly, I would tell them this. And it might be hard for you to accept that advice, but I think it's easier for it to filter through to you than someone who just says, oh, don't worry, or nothing bad's going to happen. We don't say nothing bad's going to happen because sometimes bad things do happen. That's not a good way to have an absolute, like, nothing. It's not going to happen. Nothing bad's going to happen because it could happen. That doesn't help a worrier to tell them nothing. It's not going to happen. You're going to be fine. There is a chance. What helps a worrier is to assign probabilities. So one thing I've started doing now when I have something to worry about is I say, all right, what is the best case scenario? What is the worst case scenario? And what is likely going to happen? And I try to assign probabilities to that. So let's say you're afraid of flying. What is the best case scenario? I'm going to fly across the country and I'm going to have an enjoyable time. The middle seat's going to be open next to me and I'm going to get extra snacks and I'm just going to have a good time. That's the best case scenario. What is the worst case scenario? The plane is going to crash and I'm going to die a painful death. And what's probably going to happen? I'm going to fly across the country. I'll be mildly uncomfortable, but I'll be glad that I did it. And then try to think, what are the probabilities? You know, best case scenario? Who knows? That could even be like 1 out of 4, 1 out of 5. The usual case scenario, probably a 70 or 80% chance that's going to happen. The worst case scenario, you could look up, but if you just had to spitball it, how many planes crashed in the last year, major commercial jetliners in the United States, and you can remember, honestly. And then you go look at the data. If I had to put it top of my head, it's probably the odds of dying in a plane crash, and a 1 in 50,000, 1 in 100,000. Even if you highballed it, you know, let's say it's 1 in 10,000. Would you take a bet for 1 in 10,000 and think you're going to win money? I mean, I kind of joke about this with Catholic couples. Remember in the lottery when it was $1.6 billion was the jackpot? I bought a ticket because, you know, I knew I was not going to win. But I bought a ticket. I talked about this in the gambling podcast. Because I was willing to spend a dollar to have 2 hours to have a pleasant thought about what it'd be like to be a billionaire or a half a billionaire after taxes and the good I would do with the money. You know, I spent a dollar to have a fun little thought about that, whatever. But it's funny what we do with odds. So when it comes to the lottery, odds are 1 in 300 million. Maybe we will. The Catholic view of statistics, 1 in 300 million, maybe we will become millionaires. What are the odds that we're going to get pregnant during this part of our cycle? I don't know, 1 in 4. I don't think we'll get pregnant. You know, this is the Catholic. I always think about that when Catholics look at NFP and they're so bad at rangy statistics. You know, 1 in 4, it's probably not going to happen. 1 in 300 million, we're going to be millionaires. So we don't handle statistics well. But when you look at that, what is the best case? What is the worst case scenario? And what's probably going to happen? And you assign probabilities to them. I've done that with things, and it instantly calms me down. Best case, worst case, probably. And in a lot of cases, the best case scenario is what's probably going to happen. When the best case is, well, this terrible thing won't happen. And so that helps you know, okay, the best case is the most probable. All right. Other things that you can do is to try to identify when you have distorted thinking. To say, I'm having a thought about this, is that distorted thinking? And Leahy lists all different kinds of distorted thinking. I'll give you a few examples. You engage in fortune telling. This is going to be terrible. This is going to happen. We're going to go to Disneyland. Everyone's going to be cold, wet, and miserable. You don't know that. I didn't know that. And I was wrong. We got there. It drizzled a little. We had an umbrella. We had covers on the stroller. But then the rain went away and we were fine. My fortune telling was wrong. We're really bad at predicting the future. So you don't know that. this is going to be terrible. How about you don't know exactly what's going to happen, but if that situation arises, you'll make a decision then, not now. Mind reading. This person, my coworker, hates me. My mom is mad at me. I know that she's really angry with me. She's upset. If you say that and it's simply from your own conjecture, you don't know that. Assume the best in people until you have concrete evidence otherwise, being that they've told you I'm really upset with you right now. And then you can do something with that. But if you engage in mind reading with other people, you may just be projecting your own worries on to other people. Catastrophizing is another one. You start even just saying to yourself, oh, this horrible thing's going to happen. And you take it to, the podcast is going to go under and I'm going to be homeless and Catholic Answers will fire me and it'll be terrible. Just to say, I'm catastrophizing right now. And say that I am turning this into the absolute worst case scenario without good reason to do that. I am just to even say, I'm catastrophizing. It puts a label onto the distortion you're doing, and that takes you away from that. Finally, the thing that I would recommend is writing stories and keeping journals. So one thing that can help you here is writing out a story about a best case scenario. Just saying, okay, what would be the best case scenario right now in this situation, and write a story about it happening. Sit down with a pen and paper. This happens, then this happens, and then I was happy. Here's what happened with the best case scenario. Great. Now, identify within that best case scenario, what were steps? What were things that I could do in this situation? What were steps that I could do? And when you're looking at steps and solutions to something, if I'm worrying and I say, okay, I have a worry, I have a thought about this, what can I do about it now? Don't reject an imperfect solution. There's an old adage, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Sometimes we won't choose to do something because it has a negative outcome involved, even if it's a minor negative thing, a discomfortable thing. Well, guess what? Any solution we pick to a problem is probably going to have something negative about it we don't like, a negative feeling, having to do something difficult. So we refuse to do anything, but that itself is a solution to choose to do nothing with lots of negatives for most of our problems. So when you look at solutions and survey, here's things I could do, don't wait for the perfect solution. You say, well, I'm worried about my finances. I don't even look at my bank account. Okay, well, you could, let's look at a bank account and see where the money's going and work on a budget. Yeah, but my budget is not going to solve the fact that I'm $30,000 in debt. Okay, you're right. A budget won't solve your entire problem. It's not a perfect solution, but it will solve part of your problem, which is making your financial situation worse. So start with a good solution, even if it's imperfect, even if it can't solve everything. If it can solve something, then you can start adding other solutions on top of it. Also, when it comes to keeping the journal, so writing a story, keeping a worry journal can be helpful. So you can say, all right, I'm worried about this. I have a worried thought about this. Make a prediction about what you think honestly is going to happen. What is the most probable outcome? What is the most probable outcome that will happen to this? Write down your prediction in your journal. Then, when the situation arises, write down the outcome and write down how you felt. What was your feeling when that outcome emerged? So prediction, the outcome, and your feeling of the things that you're worried about. And so what's great is that a lot of times we worry, people will say things like this. It always turns out fine, Trent. Trent, you always worry about this and everything turns out fine. And what do? We discount it. Remember, we seek reassurance. That was one that doesn't work. So we discount it. Say, oh, I don't believe you. You're just saying that to make me feel better. But when we can hold the journal in our hands and flip through it and say, wow, things really did turn out well. They did turn out okay, even in very similar circumstances here. That when we were able to do that, we were able to see, okay, I have a reference here that allows me to have some certainty, a little bit of certainty to know, hey, things often do turn out well. And even when they don't, I have been able to handle it. I have survived. And I will continue to follow not just this advice, but ultimately what Jesus said, to remember that God gave me my life. He didn't give it to me to worry, that we can know that we can survive discomfort, even really terrible things that happen, because we have a God who loves us, who cares about us, and has our ultimate good waiting for us with him. So remember, Matthew 6:27, Jesus said, and which of you by being anxious can add one cubit, 1 minute to his span of life? You can't. I hope that all of this was very helpful to you on a free-for-all Friday to free you from worrying and free you up for a worry-free weekend. The book is The Worry Cure by Robert Leahy. I hope it helps you, and I hope you have a blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.